Cannibalism, one of the last taboos. Sweeney Todd, the demon barber of Fleet Street, is a fictional character who murdered customers and gave the corpses to a neighbour to make into meat pies, which are then sold to the general public. There is no barber or neighbour in this episode, nor meat pies. Just a roadside stand selling pulled pork and beef sandwiches that had rave reviews. A serial killer who cooked and ate his victims and fed the leftovers to unsuspecting customers. But was it all lies? This is the case of Joseph Metheny, and this is Murder Me on Monday.
Hello everyone, welcome back to the Murder Me on Monday podcast. I am Cameron, and joined with me is Mother.
Hello.
A big thank you to our most recent Patreon subscriber, Mark C, who bro just comes out of nowhere, drops a top tier Patreon sub.
Yes, we're very Thanks. Grateful.
And thank you to Sophie D. They just sound like Geordie Shore characters for being our first podcast hosting supporter. I don't know how that works, but we've got one now, so thank you.
Yes.
Thank I don't you know how it works. I don't know how we get paid for it, but it says that we've got one, which is nice because we've not had one before.
If you would like to support us via patreon.com, where you get early access and exclusive content and stickers should you want them, please do consider it. Links in our bio. Oh, and stickers. We have had a request for personalised ones. And after I picked myself up off the floor, Cameron wants to go for it.
This is about my nipples.
Yes.
Okay, fuck, this sounds
so
weird.
So stand by. We're talking to graphic designers, or trying to at the moment, because it's not your run-of-the-mill type thing.
It's not that I have weirdly big nipples, by the way.
No.
It's not a big job because I've got a big nipple or something.
No, we want to come out with some new stickers as well, which you guys who are our Patreon subscribers will get. I'll keep an update and send you some more for these new ones as well. There's a new exclusive episode up on Patreon. Should be live by the time you hear this, hopefully, about a serial killer in Texas that no one has heard of. It's gotten lost in lockdown partly, but it's a nasty one that may get you thinking. We're working on upping output for our exclusive content, so hope you enjoy it. I know we've talked about doing a series on Unsolved for Patreon, but I'm not sure I can. I just hate them. Although there is one unsolved case from France from the 1980s that's haunted me for years, so that may well yet be an episode. We are also going to give an unrequested and unpaid plug to a listener who's very active on Reddit. The Bones of Autumn, brilliant published writer whose piece on good old Ted Carr from episode 82 set me off researching on that case. They mainly specialised in Unsolved, so if that's your thing and like a good read, please do check them out. I'll link as usual. The reason we do Solved is the certainty. I prefer the murderers to be dead, but locked up and never getting out is good too.
Also, I can't slag someone off and then turns out they're innocent.
Yeah.
Because then I look bad.
Yeah. Blow me down. We're at episode 100. I ought to have bought some fizz, Cameron. Genuinely didn't think we would get here. It's been a tough learning curve, but that's what life's all about, eh? I asked listeners for case suggestions to mark this momentous occasion and got told anything that will get your knickers in a knot. So this one might, if we take it on face value.
If we're being honest, we've done more than 100 because we've split apart into two and we've done Patreon exclusives. So this is probably about 110, if we're being honest.
Yeah, but...
The last one was like 99.11, basically. And now this is like official 100, which is cool, I guess. It's a pretty big milestone.
Yeah. Now, we've covered cannibals a few times, but this is a case of smoke and mirrors, I think. The research revealed so much that can't be corroborated. And whilst he looked, in all the pressed photos, like an English singer called Buster Blood Vessel, the Scar Group Bad Manners from the 1980s, you have to be a certain age to get it. I think he's more of a Billy Bullshitter, to be honest.
He looks like a true Brexit geezer. He's bald, bloke's like 25 stone, wears glasses, heavily tattooed, beats his wife Susan. He's got 8 kids, don't know the name of 7 of them. He looks like one of those. Honestly, if you see a picture of him, which will be posted on the Instagram, he looks like a true Brexit geezer.
Let us begin.
Pour a beer. Bosh.
I'm not going to rise to that. Let us begin on the 2nd of March 1955, when Joseph Roy Metheny, or Joe as he was known, was born in Baltimore, Maryland. For those that don't know, and that included me, Baltimore is on the east coast of the USA, population of around 600,000 and about 188 miles south of New York, for reference. Joe was a normal, ordinary child, one of six children born to married parents originally from West Virginia, whose laborer father had died when Joe was 6 years old. Mum had to work multiple jobs just to keep them afloat, and she did the best she could. And whilst they were never well-to-do, they were never on welfare, and she kept them fed and a roof over their heads. There are no reports of neglect or abuse. Joe was described as a good student, polite and well-mannered, and nothing remotely would have set off the future serial killer vibes. Joe's version of his childhood varies substantially from that, but I'll explain later. 1973. Joe, then aged 18, joins the US Army. Everyone agrees he went to Germany, but his claim that he ended up in Vietnam can't be substantiated. There's no records that are available to the public, and it's never seems to have been delved into by any of the legal teams.
Early 70s, right?
Yeah, well, the USA withdrew from the war in 1975. So it's possible he was there, but they usually have to serve 10 to 12 months, and the chances of coming back were slim. So I don't know. I don't know.
It'd have been 73 by the time he went.
Yeah.
And that's after the initial training, so the likelihood of him going there would have been a max a year. So it could have been a 12-month deployment. He definitely went to Germany, but
yeah,
the Vietnam one. Hmm.
We've no idea when he left the army, what type of discharge, but everything states he had a roaring drug problem when he got back to the USA.
And that's from being in Germany, you think? Because you can't cooperate the Vietnam thing.
Yeah, but apparently in Vietnam it was very, very common for them to become drug addicts out there for them to cope. So we just don't know. When he comes back to the USA, he goes no contact with his family, and his mother blamed his drug addiction, but there's nothing forthcoming anywhere from his siblings on any relationship. There's never any speech about them. So in the 1990s, he's holding down a perfectly respectable job as a forklift driver. No one had a bad word to say about him at work. Outside of work, well, that was a different matter. By that point, he was spending all his money on booze. Apparently, Southern Comfort was his poison of choice, crack cocaine and heroin, and hanging around in bars or spending time with the homeless in the camps that were in the south of Baltimore.
I don't think the old appetite suppressant part of crack and heroin kicked in.
No. Well, I'll get into that.
If he's a cannibal, he ate about three football teams. Like a true Brexit geezer.
He's known as Tiny, a rather predictable name given he's 6'1" and at that point around 350 pounds. Lots of places have questioned his weight due to this drug addiction, as Cameron just said. And it's somewhat unusual to be a heroin addict, yet as large as he was, but it's perfectly possible. Rare, it can happen. You don't have to look like an emaciated runway model to have that addiction. But let's just say at that size, which is around 25 stone, he's not winning any marathons, but he is super intimidating. You could outrun him very easily, but if he connected a punch, it wouldn't end well. Add to that the extensive tattoos he had and the teardrop ones by his eyes. He was creepy.
Certain teardrop, if they're like a blackened teardrop by the eye, I think that can mean teetotal, which means you don't do anything.
Well, he definitely wasn't. Yeah,
exactly.
But I also thought it was a gang thing as well.
Yeah, it can be, but I know of a few people that are very heavily tattooed. I'm talking if they grow their hair out, it looks normal. They shave their head and it's completely covered.
Mm.
They have a tattoo by the eye that's a teardrop. And that to them, that's a teetotal thing. But he's Australian, so it depends. It might depend where you're from.
Yeah. Your friend, you mean? That's got, yeah. July 1994. Joe is working at a pallet making factory and he meets a drug addicted sex worker called Catherine Magaziner. Some places say she was 39, some say she was 45. Joe persuades her to go back to the factory. There is a trailer or caravan they can use. No one will disturb us. Sex took place. It may have been a transaction for money or drugs, but afterwards he strangles her. Firstly with an extension cord and then finally with his hands. He takes her clothing and handbag and buries it in a spot behind the factory in the woods and then buried Catherine in a separate spot and goes about his business. That same month, July 1994, Joe, who is a father of a six-year-old boy with what he described as a drug-addled, insert your preferred abusive description here, girlfriend, and he comes home from work one day, By then he was a truck driver, and finds she has upped and left, cleared the home out and taken his son. I did read one report that said his girlfriend had found out what he had done to Catherine and had fled in terror. Now, as I said, he's a scary mofo, so I could believe that part of the tale. He's not interested in her coming home. Joe just wants his son back. After 6 months, he finds out that she was living with another man. Basically, he was living off immoral earnings. He was selling the woman. The woman and the man were arrested for drug possession, and the child was put into foster care. Joe had a criminal record, bar brawls, assault, and drug possession, and knew he wouldn't be able to get his child out of foster care, and he hated his ex and the new bloke for that. Joe goes looking for them. He knows where to look. He knows that she is likely to be able to score around the homeless camps he knows so well. So he goes looking for her under the Hanover Street Bridge in Baltimore, where there was a tent city. Now, this is a big bridge over the Patapsco River. There we go, got it out. 5 lanes of traffic, but actually has pavements or sidewalks on either side, which is really unusual for an American bridge, I think. He didn't find his ex-girlfriend, but he kept returning and asking people if they knew of her whereabouts. And life went on. Except Joe goes back to where he had buried Catherine about 6 months after he killed her. He digs her up, removes her skull, but leaves the lower jawbone intact. He puts the skull in a box and puts it in a dumpster and then reburies Catherine.
Why?
No idea.
Relive the moment? Thinks maybe something's going to get done in that area? You say it's behind the factory, didn't you?
Yeah.
Could you be aware of any sort of building that's going to be going on?
No, there was nothing. It was literally at the end of a track. It's...
A nothing?
Yeah, it's nothing. I don't get it. Life went on. Joe carries on going back to the tent city to see if he could track his ex down. The camp was actually split into 2 factions and they hated each other. No rhyme nor reason to anyone that didn't live there in that environment. But in July of 1995, Joe gets into an argument with 2 of the guys from one group, Randall Brewer and Randy Piker, who were both 33 years old. Joe knew that these guys knew his ex, but they were not giving him the information he wanted on her whereabouts. He beats them to death with an axe and then hides the axe under a pile of grotty mattresses and leaves the bodies where they lay on top of each other on another grotty mattress. This next bit comes from Joe himself. The police are never able to verify it when he tells them about it years later, and we are into Billy Bullshitter territory. According to Joe, after killing these 2 men, that same night, he carries on looking for his ex. He meets another homeless female drug addict who he thinks he may know where his ex is. She denies knowing anything, so he sexually assaults her, beats her until he kills her, then hides her body in some bushes. Joe goes out and finds another homeless female drug addict and does exactly the same thing to her. But this time, according to what he says, before he can throw her into the bushes, he is spotted by an old man who is innocently fishing in the nearby river. Joe then grabs a metal pipe that's laying about and, in his own words, ran down on him, laid his head wide open. So I put the 2 girls and him in the river and weighed them down with rocks. He then washes himself up in the river and he leaves.
I don't get why he's motivated to do this at this point.
No. It's hatred for his ex, but...
But why is it targeted towards other people? In a lot of cases that we've covered, it's usually an interpersonal issue.
He thinks they know where his ex is and he's determined to kill his ex.
I know he's got substance abuse issues, so that can explain a large majority of it away, but I don't get why he's just randomly killing these 2 people. He called the sex worker, behind the factory of all places.
Two and a half weeks later, on the 2nd of August 1995, police are called to the camp after the body of yet another homeless man called Everett Dowell from the other faction had been found. He too had been beaten to death with an axe. A guy called Larry Amos had stolen or found the axe that Joe had hidden and killed this Everett chap with it. Larry's actions caused the bodies of Joe's first victims to be found. It's not clear how long before he had killed them, but Joe is arrested along with Larry. The police must have been scratching their heads over that. They've got three bodies, two murderers, one weapon. Joe is slung in jail.
Sounds like Cluedo, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. In the conservatory.
Colonel Mustard by the crack tent. Yeah.
So Joe's slung in jail and he ends up sitting there. Larry Amos is convicted of manslaughter and sentenced to 8 years. He was released after serving 18 months. Joe goes on trial in July 1996. After a trial that lasted a week, the jury says that there is not enough evidence to convict and he is released. The jury actually sent a note to the judge saying that they thought one of the other guys in the homeless camp was responsible. Joe goes back to his old employer and persuades the boss to give him his job back and let him live in that trailer behind the factory that made pallets. The trailer that he had killed Catherine in a couple of years before. The factory boss didn't mind him living there. He was on-site security for them and it gave him privacy. No one to see his comings and goings after work. As I said, it was at the end of a track and it was isolated. We have someone who by now has reached serial killer levels with 6 murders under his belt by his own account, living as a site security guard. That's July of 1996. And this is where we get into urban legend or Billy Bullshitter territory again, as there is no evidence, just the tales he tells people later.
Is that within prison or people investigating afterwards?
He has does press interviews. So he's in prison, but he does press interviews. Now, this is in his words. Yeah. Excuse the language. I lured 2 more crack whores up there to my trailer. I killed and butchered their bodies. I cut the meat up and put it in some Tupperware bowls and then put it in a freezer. I buried the remains in several shallow graves in little woods behind the company. Over the next couple of weeks, on the weekends, I opened up a little open pit beef stand. I had real roast beef and pork sandwiches, and why not? They were very good. The human body tastes very similar to pork. If you mix it together, no one can tell the difference. Everything was going pretty good until I ran out of my special meat. Well, what happened when he ran out of his special meat? He goes looking for a new supply. The 11th of November, 1995, he meets a 23-year-old unemployed crack cocaine addict called Kimberly in a local bar. She was a lost soul. She had had a fight that day with her family and was grieving her brother, who had died just a few days previously of a heroin overdose. This girl, Kimberly, and Joe are sort of acquaintances. She knew him, even said she felt sorry for him as he was so polite and nice. Why that quote, I'm not sure. Maybe he was a sorry figure missing his son. I don't know. But he persuades her to go back to that trailer, probably to share drugs. It ended up with Joe stabbing her in the head and killing her. He does what a lot of serial killers do at this point. He gets lazy, sloppy, and simply puts her body underneath another trailer in the yard about 10 foot away. It's November. It's going to be cold. There will be little to no smell. And I did wonder why a pallet company had 2 trailers sat in its yard. Kimberly's mother spends 2 weeks looking for her daughter. She's still grieving her son and probably worried at the same time something had happened to Kimberly as happened to her son. But eventually, after 2 weeks, she reports her as missing. Police? Well, it goes nowhere, even if they looked. She's a drug addict. They've probably written her off. Joe's sloppiness is his undoing. When on the 8th of December, he invites a woman by the name of Rita Kemper back to his trailer to share some drugs. They had known each other a few months by the sounds of things, and she had initially no qualms about going. Yet, when he ordered her to take off her clothing voluntarily, or he would do it by force, she knew what was likely on the cards and was terrified, especially when he informed her that screaming wouldn't help, no one could hear, and she wasn't getting out alive, and he was going to bury her in the woods with the other girls. She runs. He manages to catch her. Seems he'd slimmed down a bit by then. He beats her as he drags her back to the trailer and starts to forcibly remove her clothing. He turned his back for a moment, and it was enough for Rita to bolt again. Half naked, this time she gets to an 8-foot chain link fence that's topped with barbed wire, and she gets over it. What happens next, according to Joe, hint, it's not the truth. She manages to get to a local police station and calls the police. Joe knows what's coming, so what does he do? He unlocks the gates and he waits. Police turn up, weapons drawn. Joe was ordered to the ground and cuffed. When he's put in the back of the police car, he says to the officer, "You don't have to be scared." The officer responds that he isn't. And Joe then says, "You ought to be." Now, there is a report in the local paper that says that the owner of the pallet company, a Joseph E. Stein, then aged 61, was also charged with being an accessory after the fact for helping to dispose of evidence. I can't find anything further on that, but the report also says that he and Joe were arrested as they left a Christmas party, which is incorrect. What actually happened is a bit more sinister. Joseph E. Stein is Joe Sr. He has a bit of a record himself, which is probably why he didn't care about Joe Metheny's record. He had been convicted of arson in 1985 and theft in 1988, and the FBI were very interested in him by 1996 for gun violations. They get chatting to Joseph Jr., Stein's son, who agrees to help with the case against his dad, and they eventually relocate him, so probably witness protection. But there is another chap who is less than a good outstanding citizen working at the factory. This is a guy called William. This chap calls the FBI and tells them that Joe Metheny has shown him a dead body. What did the FBI do? The FBI paid for William to go through drug rehab, covered his rent when he went into hiding as a cooperating witness, and also had to reimburse the owner of a house that William stayed in when the guy accused William of stealing tools valued about $5,000. I mean, good job they had Joe's confession and the body, right? There are a lot of interviews with police, and this is where Joe tells them about Catherine. Remember her from the beginning? They are given a map and directions to where he had buried her and her belongings. They search, but can't find anything. So eventually, they take Joe out there in cuffs to show them exactly where he had buried Catherine. Joe is captured on film by reporters, and it shows a very, very different Joe from the initial pictures. Whilst not buff, he doesn't look overweight at all. They find Catherine's body about 10 foot away from Joe said he had buried her, but not her clothes and purse. Now, I'm like, how the hell did they not expand it out? Never mind. Police are somehow able to identify her by dental records eventually, so perhaps someone did report Catherine as missing. Joe goes big on the storytelling again. He tells the police about the two girls and the man he killed at the homeless camp. Police never find any evidence. And I know rivers flow, that river actually flows out to the Chesapeake Bay, which has its fair share of murder victims to its name. But three bodies in one act, something would have been found surely. The old man. Someone would have known he was missing if he wasn't part of the camp. We have nothing further. and the police don't believe that they are real victims, as in it never happened. Joe also says he did kill the two guys at the encampment, Randall Brewer and Randy Piker, but it was because he wanted to steal $300 from one of them. December 1996, Joe is charged with three murders. Catherine Magaziner, she was unidentified at that time. Kimberly, and a whole new name, Toni Ingracia, who was 28. She had been found on the side of the road very close to that pallet company and was also a known drug addict, although that charge was eventually dropped due to lack of evidence. That's a huge coincidence, isn't it? I feel sorry for Tony's family. They've got no answers. 5th of November, 1997. Joe goes on trial for Rita's assault, kidnapping, attempted sexual assault and attempted murder. The defence was funny, if it wasn't so preposterous, but it's also in light of what we know about him, which the court didn't at the time. The defence said it was a simple dispute which had all been blown up. They say he's gentle and kind and they believe every word he says. Now, I know a defence attorney is supposed to believe their client, but... The defence attorneys were on a hiding to nothing because he lied about everything. He told them he got hooked on heroin when serving in Vietnam, yet his mother says he wasn't in Vietnam. Timings also didn't match. He told his lawyers his mother was dead. She responded that he probably hoped she was. He told his lawyers that whilst he didn't go into official foster care, he was shipped about to stay with family and friends for long periods, and his mother neglected all of them. She was able to refute that too, saying that while she worked, he'd never lived with anyone else, and she may not have been at home all the time because she was working to keep the family together. It was a normal childhood. One could think he was scarred, or she would blow his lies out of the water, which is why Joe said she was dead. Oddly enough, there is nothing from his siblings anyway, as I said before. Daddy was also an abusive alcoholic, but there may be truth in the story as the accounts of his death in a road traffic accident only state it was a drunk driving accident, not who was drunk driving. Joe is convicted in Rita's case, given a sentence of 50 years for kidnapping and attempted sexual assault. He was acquitted of attempting to murder her. April 1998. Another trial for the murder and assault and robbery of Kimberly. It comes out that a medical examiner found a bottle inside her body. Didn't get there by itself now, did it? The prosecution's case was that he tried to assault her with the bottle and she fought back when Joe stabbed her in the face and neck and she was still fighting. She was no match for Joe and he stabbed her in the chest, stomach and back 9 times. The defence attorneys went for that Kimberly went willingly with him. He just killed for the thrill. And Joe apparently had a history of sex with dead women. But as necrophilia is not a crime in Maryland and the bottle happened after death, it's not a crime. Joe is found guilty of the murder of Kimberly after 3 weeks. And in May of 1998, the judge said he hadn't robbed her or sexually assaulted her, so no death penalty, but a life sentence. September of 1998, he was charged with the first degree premeditated murder and robbery of Catherine Magaziner. The shocker is he pled guilty and was given the death penalty on the 13th of November 1998. And then he appealed it. If you want to read the appeal, I've linked it, but it boils down to the robbery was the reason he got the death penalty and he pled guilty against his lawyer's advice, then wanted the robbery charge overturned because they'd never found any of Catherine's belongings. So they couldn't say he intended to keep anything and the robbery charge was the reason behind the death penalty. Kind of blew back on him at trial because the pathologist was able to categorically state there was absolutely no evidence of Catherine wearing any clothing in that grave and no evidence of any purse, etc. So she wasn't buried with them. There was no rivets which they expected to see or anything like that. And the point of the charge is that he intended to deprive her of her belongings. Eventually, he won the appeal, July of 2000. Very long, convoluted legal argument, but it boiled down to Maryland law allowing the death penalty only in cases with certain aggravating factors. And that included killing someone whilst also committing or attempting to commit carjacking, robbery, arson, or first-degree sexual offence. But the court was actually split 4-3 whether Joe should have been convicted of the robbery. Majority said that despite the conviction for robbery, it did not meet the definition of an aggravated circumstance. What it boiled down to is that Joe wasn't robbing her, then killed her. He killed her, then robbed her.
So that's just an argument of semantics.
Yeah, it doesn't meet the threshold. It's
that's fucking dumb.
Yeah. No.
The outcome's the same, isn't it?
I read it, then I had to read the dissent in, and I read it again, and I'm thinking, am I really believing this?
That's just that is just a semantic argument.
Yeah.
Because if it's happened regardless, the outcome is the same.
The thing is,
who cares if you're kicked then punched or punched then kicked? You've still got a bruised forehead. Like, I don't care if he did it after the fact. Because then surely, if you want to steal something from someone, aren't you? I'm not saying you're encouraged to kill them first, but I'm saying if you're going to rob them anyway and you were going to kill them, then just do it that way then, because then it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But then you'd have to prove that it happened one way around, but not the other. I don't get it. What the fuck? I know you make some good cookies, Maryland, but you've not done it right with your law. That makes no sense.
Yeah. Well, Joe's going nowhere. Life without parole and separate sentences. So consecutive, not concurrent. So 2003, Joe is sat there in prison giving these interviews I mentioned about. Mr. Billy Bullshitter says he weighs 450 pounds, so about 32 stone, but claims it's not all fat. Joe states that he killed 7 people, 3 men and 4 women. Now, let's look at those figures. 3 men. The 2 homeless guys, Randy and Randall, and the fisherman. No evidence on him. 4 women. Catherine, Kimberly, the 2 women by the encampment and dumped in the river. There's no evidence there. That same article is where he says he killed 2 women for his special meat. So who were they? Did he use parts of Catherine and Kimberly? Can't find any mention of that. The bit that was frustrating about the case is all the contradictions came from the same newspaper, and there were only 2 newspapers that really reported it, and one was years after the fact. There are very probably more murders he is responsible for. Figures are bandied about of between 5 and 13 kills. And he told the police he had killed 10.
His murders seem to be hedonistic in nature.
Yes.
Rather than for a proper motivation. He's doing it purely based... It's not even based off pleasure. I kind of don't actually get why he's done it.
No.
I don't get what his motivation has been. He's not really doing it for drugs, because you can argue that he has the means to get drugs already, kind of. Even just financially. He has a house above his head. He has a roof above his head.
Yeah.
Again, kind of. I don't quite understand the motivation behind it.
I also found a link to Joe's prison artwork. I'm sorry, Cameron, I forgot to send you this. Yet again, he perhaps has some talent. I mean, we all know I'm not an art connoisseur, but it's gruesome when you know who's behind it. They are cartoon-like characters. But if you look closer, there is dismemberment. No blood and gore, but it's odd to look at.
The art style is pseudo-caricature, but there is a lot of imagery of... Lack of limbs. Oh, and a lot of it is also quite graphic. It's like pornographic almost. It's like, it's a bit fucking weird. But if I was a prisoner guard, but no, you can't draw this. It's bad.
Did he really make special meat sandwiches? We only have his word for it. Funnily enough, those rave reviews I mentioned at the beginning... There's no trace of those, and nor has anyone come forward to say, yeah, he had that stand I ate there on the record. There are loads of remarks on the YouTube videos from other creators that have made about the case that they say they did eat there, but there's nothing official. Not one of these people has said anywhere that they made a police statement. If anyone offers you what they call long bone pork, decline.
Or long pig.
Yeah, apparently it's a name given to human flesh by some cultures.
Because it tastes like pig.
But if Joe is telling the truth, He isn't the first and probably won't be the last. And there are a lot of urban legends and myths around these cases. I found a case from 2012. Three people in Brazil killed and ate at least three women as a ritual of their religious sect. Husband and wife team and a third person. They used leftovers, extra human meat, to stuff empanadas, which is like mini pasties for us uninitiated, which obviously I am because I can't pronounce it, which they then sold to their neighbours and made a tidy profit. There's also an infamous case from 1999 in the USA, Kip Arts. He and his wife owned a small taco and pizza shop. He got sick, either a stroke or a heart attack, and he seems to have suffered brain damage or something similar from it. And then he killed and dismembered his wife and then deep fried her. There is no indication anywhere that she was served to any customers because the place was shut as he was unable to work. And no indication that he ate her. He got a life sentence, but it's quite controversial. And there's no explanation given for why he did what he did. Oh, and Buster Bloodvessel, the real name of Douglas Trendle. He's alive and kicking and still performing at the age of 64. Lost a load of weight through a gastric bypass. He's also famous for us oldies for owning a hotel in Margate called Fatty Towers, which specifically catered for larger customers, but the hotel closed in 1998. There are lots of things drifting about the internet calling Joe the hamburger killer and variations on that. But there's no mention of all beef patties with the secret ingredient being human. His own words don't say so. So I don't know. Bigging up the story to make him scarier in prison? There are some undertones in some things I read that the police did believe him to an extent. And perhaps there were missing body parts. But again, I can't find anything official. So it's urban legend built from a known liar.
A lot of prisoners do openly discuss the crimes they've committed. It's not so much a rite of passage or a mark of what you've done. It's what else is there to talk about? There's not much. But people will often embellish it. You know, people that don't talk about it are rats or tromos, child molesters. They're the people that don't talk about it. And they're often in like a protected wing. In some of the pictures that you've sent me, he seems to have a, I don't know, I want to say like a 16-inch scar that goes from just below his sternum down to below his belly button, and he doesn't have a belly button. So either he's had a horrendous hernia and had the surgery for it, or he's potentially had what looks like his large intestine removed, because he's also got a scar on his right-hand side that looks like an indent, which to me would be where a stoma bag would go. The only reason I know that is because I know a little bit about this, because I've done research for people about improving their gut biome. So I'm thinking, oh, that leads down the ulcerative colitis side and stuff. So I don't know if he's had that. Because if you search his name, because when I searched his name, Joe Metheny, the first thing that popped up was burger. And that's then when I searched art, and I could then find out what weird shit he had drawn. But looking at that, that's not just a simple scratch. That's like an inch deep and about 16 inches long. It's hard to tell because this fucker's stomach is massive. So is that 16 inches or is it more? I don't know. It's a lot. But that it looks like he's had some sort of gastric surgery.
Well, I did wonder that. But his weight seemed to fluctuate so wildly.
Well, I'm not thinking it's a bariatric surgery where they've essentially cut half his stomach out. It looks exactly like someone that I know that's had what I had described there. It looks like that. I don't know if that led to him then losing weight because he physically can't eat as much because the bioavailability of food is so much worse.
There's no mention
but
anywhere.
I don't know. If he's been a chronic drug user... and alcoholic, etc. And before psoriasis, the liver could lead to some funky stuff with gut biome. Oh, it's an autoimmune disease. Are you telling me injecting heroin and doing crack and shit and doing all this other stuff isn't going to potentially lead to problems, bro? I don't know. That's what it looks like to me.
That one photograph is the only one where he appears to be sunbathing, and it looks
he's basking. It's not sunbathing. He's basking.
Well, yeah. Until you said that earlier, I hadn't even, it not occurred to me. It just looked like a revolting picture of this.
Because it isn't just a normal scar. He's got where his hands are holding onto his stomach, they're indented. So that just looks like the indent. But above that, he has an extra dent that he's not touching. It could be just a skin fold, but that's what it looks like to me anyway. I'm not sure if it mentions that anywhere. I don't know where it would be. I don't even know how he could afford it because it's probably not cheap because it's a very long surgery.
Yeah, he wouldn't have had the money for it. Absolutely, categorically. So it may well be one of those
things. I guess why would a news place want a report on it? Where would he divulge this information? I don't know.
No one's ever written a book on him, I don't think.
I'd want people that are listening to this to either look at our Instagram or just search his name, Joe Metheny.
Yeah. tell us what you think when you look at the pictures.
And then Google day in the life of a true Brexit geezer and then compare the images and you'll see why I said this. I'm going to get you to look at the picture of it at the end of it and you're going to go, oh, fuck, it's the same person.
But Buster Blood Vessel, as he was, he had this thing where he always had his tongue were hanging out.
Yeah.
And it just reminded me.
Are they not the same people?
No.
Oh, because yes. I can see at the bottom, they look like the same fucking people then. Okay.
Yeah.
Hiding in plain sight. I thought that was the same person.
No.
But yeah, that's all I wanted to mention. Because it's never made... I can see pictures of burgers.
Yeah, there's no burgers anywhere. It was this pork and beef sandwiches, which... I don't know what they would have been. It's roast beef. You don't make roast beef patties, do you?
I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah. So the 5th of August 2017, Joe is found dead in his cell at the Western Correctional Facility in Cumberland, Maryland, 22 years into his life sentence. He was 62 years old and he looked a lot older in those last mugshots.
Do they know why he died?
Heart failure, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah. And that is the end of this week's episode, our momentous 100th. Finally, the victims who should not be forgotten. Randy Piker, Randall Brewer, Catherine Magazina, Kimberly Spicer.
And that is the end of the episode. If you've liked it, please like, favorite, subscribe. I would say leave a message for the algorithm, but we don't necessarily have one because I don't upload to YouTube yet. But you can find the link to our Patreon in the show notes below in the description, all that good stuff. Find on Instagram, Murder Me Monday Podcast. Email us at murdermemondaypodcast@gmail.com. And we'll see you next time. Much love. Peace.
Bye.